Shall we rise for the reading of God's word? Today's passage is coming from Jeremiah 51, verses 52 through 58. Therefore, behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will punish her idols, and the mortal wounded will groan throughout her land. Though Babylon should ascend to the heavens, and though she should fortify her lofty stronghold, from me destroyers will come to her, declares the Lord. The sound of an outcry from Babylon, and of great destruction from the land of the Chaldeans. For the Lord is going to destroy Babylon. He will make her loud noise vanish from her, and their waves will roar like many waters. The tumult of their voices sounds forth. For the destroyer is coming against her, against Babylon, and her mighty men will be captured. Their bows are shattered, for the Lord is a God of recompense. He will fully repay. I will make her princes and her wise men drunk, her governors, her prefects, her mighty men, that they may sleep a perpetual sleep and not awake, declares the King, whose name is the Lord of hosts. Thus says the Lord of hosts, the broad wall of Babylon will be completely razed, and her high gates will be set on fire. So the peoples will toil for nothing, and the nations become exhausted only for fire. Thank you. You may be seated.
Well, the necessity or the need for total destruction in this chapter towards Babylon is clear. It has to be completely destroyed. It begins the chapter with the fact that God is going to destroy him. It will end the chapter with the destruction of Babylon. And all the way through, the word destroy is being used, as we've oftentimes made mention of. What is clear within this particular passage that we're looking at today is the necessity of that destruction for the purpose of destroying a confidence that we have or put in the things that we make that are really not secure at all. We put our confidence and trust in so many different things, and it fundamentally is that text in Jeremiah chapter 17 where he says, cursed is the one who trusts in mankind or even the things that he makes, but blessed is the one who trusts in the Lord. The curses really come because we put our trust in so many other things, but it looks like it's going to work, and we've been allured. We've bought into the system. As Jeremiah 51:7 says, Babylon has become a golden cup, intoxicating all the earth. Therefore, the nations are going mad. The fact is that we've believed the lie. And Babylon is that interesting picture of allurement that draws us into that lie. Well, you should trust in this, or you should trust in that. And we've learned to believe in it. Unfortunately, according to Isaiah 47:8, those who dwell securely, well, suddenly destruction is going to come upon them because they're not expecting it. And that really is the history that we find ourselves in at this particular moment, in which Babylon had put their trust in all of their great abilities and the things that they have made, and now in one day, in the middle of the night, Babylon will be destroyed as the Medes and the Persians come in, and they'll wipe them clean without any problems or any trouble. The confidence of the Babylonians at that juncture with Belshazzar, as we read in Daniel chapter 5, was to such an extent that though he knew the enemy was outside, he threw a party because he felt like they'll never be able to touch him. But they would. And they would drain the swamp dry. They would drain Euphrates dry, walk right under the wall, and take over the party as well as the city. We come to Jeremiah 51, verse 54, or verse 52, and through the end, and we realize that he begins to list the things that Babylon had put their trust in. I think of different moments in my life in which I finally came to the realization that the things that I was doing, the way that I was going, was either inappropriate or just a waste of time. And it's really kind of punctiliar when you think about it. It points to your time of your life in which you go, okay, that was a life-changing moment. That was a life-changing moment. When I was about somewhere around 10 years old, my mother led me to the Lord in the kitchen. That was a life-changing moment for me. But as I got a little bit older as a teenager, I remember walking down the aisle and wrestling with the whole thing of whether or not I was going to give my life to the Lord, which is kind of a strange thought because you'd already surrendered when you received Christ. But, you know, something about teen years, I don't know. What is that? So I said, no, I'm going to give my life to the Lord. And I remember doing that. But even with doing that, you start going your own way, and before long you forget your commitments. And I remember at early years I was working construction and thought that I would probably go that route and hopefully become very wealthy. And the owner of the company said he would, you know, do this for me, do that for me, and it looked, everything was going fine. But I remember sitting down with Connie. It was shortly after we had been married. I think I was probably 19 or 20. And I said, I'm just not happy. And we began talking about it. And as 1 year went, another year went, and finally we sat down together and we go, what are we doing? We're working for stupid money. Stupid money. I remember saying that. What a waste of a life to go to work and then come home and go to sleep and then go to work and come home. I mean, what a waste of time. I remember thinking that. And it was in that year that we sold everything. And we didn't know exactly what the Lord had in store for us, but went to school. And I remember midway into the school, of course, I was kind of arguing with God. I was sure he wasn't going to want me to preach. I was positive about that. But I said, you know, I'll do whatever you want. I know that preaching's not it, so whatever else you want. And I remember thinking about expectations and all that. And as I was sitting on the field, I'm opening my Bible reading. I was in between classes and working three jobs at the time. And I'm opening my Bible and I go, Galatians 1:10. I said, that's an amazing verse. And most of you know it. Do I seek to please men, or do I seek to please God? If I sought to please men, I would not be a bondservant of my Lord Jesus Christ. And that was a life-changing moment in my life, because I began to realize that it's a waste of time to try to please men. I realized at a point in time it was a waste of life to live for myself. It was a waste of time to live for money, and it was a waste of time to please men. And the Lord was weaning me off of the things of the world, because the world basically tells you that all these things are really, really important. And it's the very thing that gets you caught in this quagmire of confusion. And you wake up sorrowful and feeling meaningless, and you don't know why. Because you followed all the plans that the world has told you to follow, but it's not working. So you finally make that moment of surrender, and God says, you know what? You've been working for nothing, and that's why you're miserable. And, you know, you start investing your life in what is really important, and then instantly life begins to take on meaning, and there is a purpose to life. What God is doing within this particular passage is revealing that the world is working for nothing, and they're alluring you in it. Babylon is that Revelation even makes mention of it. Revelation 18:3, Babylon makes all the nations drunk with the wine of her passions. And they're very good. The world is very good about saying, if you'll do this, you'll be really happy. And you know, you do that, and you don't understand, because the people on TV look a lot happier than you feel. And you just don't understand why it doesn't seem to be working for you. There is a point that man can feel secure in his own wickedness, but it's just his wisdom, as he says in Isaiah, your wisdom and your knowledge have deluded you. I mean, you put your trust in your wrong stuff, and you find yourself ultimately hopeless. God's people, unfortunately, oftentimes follow suit with the things and the ways of the world, and they find themselves... I mean, a Christian can be just as miserable as a non-Christian. In fact, more so. Because you have actually, beside your conscience, a spirit. The spirit of God that goes, you shouldn't be doing this. And you're going to be just as miserable, if not more so. God is revealing that throughout the book of Jeremiah, that his people had followed suit. And he says in Jeremiah 2, without us turning to all the chapters, he says in Jeremiah chapter 2, he says, what are you doing on the road to the Nile? Why are you walking down to Egypt? What are you doing on the road to the Euphrates? Why are you heading towards Babylon? Why is it that you seem to be drawn towards these places? He says, why are you leaving a God that gives you abundant living waters for broken cisterns? You know, I oftentimes think broken cisterns really don't matter unless you're going through the desert. But you start going through a desert, and you're going to want something in that cistern, right? You're going to want something to sustain you. And it's the difficulties, it's the destruction that God sends to reveal to you. You've been trusting in broken cisterns. So he'll give these interesting analogies throughout the book of Jeremiah. Jeremiah chapter 13, he talks about this linen belt, and he says, put it in the water and let it sit there for a while. See what happens. And you go, okay, that decays. And he goes, okay, well, so, you know, there are a lot of things that look nice, but in this world, it's going to decay, and it's not going to hold up. And, it's, you know, you're trusting in things that are just pipe dreams. And so he begins to reveal to his people. In fact, in Jeremiah chapter 10, he says, you have all these idols, you know, that they've told you to build. He says, you know what they are? They're scarecrows in a cucumber patch. I don't know exactly what that means, but it sounds pretty interesting, doesn't it? Because it really seems to demonstrate that they're really nothing of any value. And you're putting your trust in these things, and there's kind of an initial confidence because everybody else seems to be confident. Does this work? Yeah, it works. And okay, you're believing that. So you're almost confident in the confidence of the world. But when it comes right down to the difficulties, it begins to reveal, okay, I've trusted in the wrong stuff. And it's the sorrows. It was a time in which I just got real with myself, and I said, I'm not really happy. I mean, if I was just honest with myself, this isn't making me happy. And it was the world and the consequences of my decisions, the pain that sometimes came with those, that was revealing the reality of those decisions. So as we come to Jeremiah 51, what he's going to be talking about is the necessity of destruction to come into your life to reveal that the things that you're trusting in are not real, they're not substantial, they're not secure, they cannot sustain you. And it's just God's grace that does that. In verse 52, if you pick up with me, he says this, therefore, behold, the days are coming, declare the Lord, when I shall punish her idols. Very interesting phrase. Now, punish, pekad, in the Hebrew, makes reference to the fact that he's talking about a visitation, or more specifically, I'm going to call to task the idols. We're going to sit down and we're going to see if they work. So it's kind of a judgment, if you would, a testing. And the day is coming when we're going to see, does this stuff work or not? I've oftentimes thought about, we lived in Illinois for a while, and I remember having the sirens go off when, you know, people, the warnings would go out when you knew there's going to be a tornado. So, you know, you open up the basement, you get in the basement, and you close the door, and hopefully, I guess you'll be safe there. But not many years after we had moved, probably just a couple, an F5 actually hit that particular town in which we lived. Some of the people that we knew had died in that tornado. When I think about the power of something like a tornado, I think about a powerful destructive force that reveals what is substantial. And you know, the bottom line with an F5 is that, you know, if a tornado of that magnitude were heading towards you, you would not be yelling out things like, save me, Red Cross. Save me, National Guard. You would not be crying, tell me, you'd be, help me, God. You know why you'd be crying out, help me, God? Because he's the only one that could help you in something like that. And so the purpose of massive destruction is it reveals the legitimacy of the things that you've been trusting in. And in this passage, he's saying, you know, I'm going to test the validity of these things that you put your trust in. The word that he uses for idols is literally where we get the phrase graven images. And the reason why we get the phrase graven images is it makes reference to the fact that they've either carved them out or they've chiseled them out. But the emphasis of it is that they formed it. They worked hard. Man made it. And his point is that you made stuff and you put your trust in something you've made. You can't even, what is it Isaiah says? Stop putting your trust in man whose breath is in his nostrils. You can't even control the oxygen in your being. How is it that you're going to make something that is going to save you? So the picture within the passage is that man works really hard to invent, to create, to, you know, through technology or through, you know, just plain hard work. He's going to in some way guarantee his safety and his security. And he goes, okay, let's test it. It's a great text, isn't it? When I shall punish your idols or test your idols, we're going to find out if that handmade stuff is actually going to work. And the mortality or the mortally wounded will groan throughout her land. Interesting picture, because the term that he uses for mortally wounded is a picture of somebody strangled. And the picture is that their sorrow and their pain is so intense that they almost can't even get out and scream. It's so intense. He says, well, we're going to find out. And what you're going to find out is that you're going to die. You're going to die because you trusted in the wrong thing. Verse 53, though Babylon should ascend to the heavens. And, of course, that's how Babylon started, wasn't it? All the way back in Genesis, in which we're going to build this tower and we're going to ascend to the heavens. It's really, once again, putting their trust in their exaltation and a sense of superiority. It's an interesting picture, ascending to heavens. It's man saying, we're better than God. You say, well, man doesn't say that. He says it every day. He says it every time he doesn't come to church on Sunday. He says it every time in which he puts his things before the things of God. He's saying he knows better than God, and so he ascends to a place of exaltation, and his perception is, I'm safe up here. Though Babylon should ascend to the heavens, and though she should fortify her lofty stronghold, literally making it inaccessible for anybody to in any way attack her. Of course, there's great confidence in the walls of Babylon at the time of Belshazzar. And once again, that's the reason why he was having a party. When he knew that the Medes and the Persians were outside, he's got this great wall. Nobody's going to touch him. There's no way they can get in here. See? So though he should fortify her lofty stronghold, from me destroyers will come. Now what God is conveying is I know your Achilles heel, I know the weakness, and besides, it doesn't matter how strong it is, I'm the one that's going to tear it on the wall. A man in his wisdom thinks that he's going to, in some way, defend himself against God. I don't know what he's thinking, but the creator of the universe, and he's going to shake his fist at God. You see that in the book of Revelation, the arrogance of man. From me, destroyers will come to her, declares the Lord. Verse 54, the sound of an outcry from Babylon, of great destruction from the land of the Chaldeans. Of course, as Habakkuk describes them in Habakkuk 1:6, these are a fierce and impetuous people. You know, who can scare them? Well, they're going to be scared. And the picture of the outcry is that they're actually crying for help. You know, those fierce Chaldeans that aren't afraid of anything, they're going to be crying out, help. For the Lord is going to destroy Babylon, and he will make her loud noise vanish from her. That's an interesting phrase. What he's conveying, of course, obviously, is the fact that Babylon through the years has been proclaiming and announcing power and majesty and glory, intimidating people. Nobody's going to knock me down type thing. And he goes, it's kind of like a bunch of noise. It kind of reminds me of Jeremiah 46:17, where it talks about Pharaoh, king of Egypt, is but a big noise. Man pontificates and he proclaims and it sounds like he knows what he's doing. He has no idea what he's up against, especially when he comes against true destruction. We were reading not too long ago about the Moabites, and of course the Moabites go, we're great mighty warriors, and God goes, you haven't even been in battle yet. And the world thinks in terms of, we can whip anything. You haven't seen major catastrophe yet. When it comes, there's nothing you can do. It doesn't matter how superior you think your source is. It's not going to make it. So the passage goes on and it says, he will make her loud noise vanish from her, and their waves will roar like many waters. The tumult of the voices sound forth. For the destroyer is coming against her, against Babylon. Once again, her making reference to the fact that Babylon has tempted and drawn us in. I mean, man makes all these things to protect himself. And, you know, you can kind of think through them, but, you know, in some ways, it may be formulas or programs or procedures. But his perception is that he's going to protect himself. The destroyer's coming against her, against Babylon. Her mighty men will be captured. Look at the phrase. Which mighty men? Well, you might could kill a mighty man, but you couldn't catch one. He goes, no, we're going to catch him. In every case, God's going to show the weakness. You don't capture a mighty man. He's going to capture this. And the phrase is ensnare them. And their bows are shattered. The deceptive destroyers of people with the ones with the bows and the arrows were perceived as deceptive destroyers because they could shoot long distances and you wouldn't even see them, but they could get you. They're really good at what they did. And he says it's just going to be completely shattered and subjugated. For the Lord is the God of recompense. He will, look at the text, repay, and I shall make, watch verse 5, her princes and her wise men drunk, and her governors, of course, these are the people of nobility, these are the people of cunning intelligence, of great skill. I'm going to make them drunk. Her governors, these are the people that are guardians, her prefects, these are the people of superintendents, and her mighty men, these are the people that are powerful and able to protect you, that they may sleep the perpetual sleep and not wake up, declares the king whose name is the Lord. Who is in charge? Obviously, it's the Lord. Thus says the Lord of hosts, the broad wall of Babylon will be completely what? Yeah, it's going to be completely destroyed. It's going to be completely laid bare. That which they perceive to be one of the greatest assets just going to be completely destroyed. And her high gates, if you look at this, which is an interesting way of describing it, because it was at the gates where the wise men would come together and begin to proclaim great things, right? It was always at the gates of the city, which was the doorway to wisdom. And he says, it's an interesting way of putting it, her high gates, not only talking about their gates, because the gates literally will come down, but her high gates is a place in which great wisdom and skill and judgment are going to be set on fire. His point is that all of the wisdom of man is not going to make any difference. If you look at the next phrase, so the peoples will toil for nothing. That's the point. They've been working for nothing. And I don't think there's anything more poignant than coming to the realization, I've worked all my life for nothing. I don't think there's any more, I don't know. I mean, I can't imagine investing my life in things that are going to go away. In Zephaniah chapter 1, if you just turn there with me, we've read it before, but just, I mean, talk about a fire sale. The declaration of Zephaniah in chapter 1 is that basically everything's going to go. Now, you know, I don't know what part of everything people aren't getting, but somehow in back of some people's minds, it's like maybe some things are going to last. Everything is going. In Zephaniah chapter 1, verse 2, I will completely remove all things. I mean, what part are we not understanding of that? From the face of the earth, declares the Lord, I'll remove man and beast, I'll remove birds of the sky, or just in case you need a list, we'll give you a list. Fish of the sea, ruins of the wicked, I cut off man from the face of the earth, declares the Lord, so I will stretch out my hand against Judah and all the inhabitants of Jerusalem, those who bow down and worship at the housetops, verse 5. I mean, everything's going. If you read in verse 14, near is the great day of the Lord, and near and coming very quickly. The day of the wrath of the Lord has come, verse 15, a day of trouble and distress, a day of destruction and desolation, a day of darkness and gloom, a day of clouds and thick darkness, a day of the trumpet and battle cry against the fortified cities, the high corners and towers. I will bring distress on men. They will walk around like blind men because they have sinned against the Lord. Their blood will be poured out like dust. Their flesh will be like dung. Neither their silver nor their gold will be able to deliver them on the day of God's wrath, and all the earth will be devoured. He will make a complete end of everything. I mean, it's conveyed very clearly there. It's conveyed very clearly in 2 Peter 3. When you go 11 through 13, he goes, okay, so all right, since everything's going to be destroyed completely, what sort of people ought we to be? I mean, obviously, everything is going. Isaiah chapter 2, of course, gives reason why this has to be. Isaiah chapter 2 gives reference to the fact that the proud look of man, and really what you're talking about is the things that man has elevated. And if you go, well, what is that? And God goes, everything. Man has elevated everything above God. I mean, we've even elevated a tree above God. We've elevated water above God. We've elevated, I mean, just go down the list. People would rather worship a spotted owl than God. So just go down the list of everything. And if you look in verse 12, the Lord of hosts will have a day of reckoning against everyone who is proud and lofty, against everyone who is lifted up, that he may be abased. And it'll be against the cedars of Lebanon, who are lofty and lifted up, against the oaks of Bashan. I told you, trees. Against all the lofty mountains, against the hills that are lifted up, against the high tower, against every fortified wall, against the ships, against the beautiful crafts. I mean, when you think about it, I mean, man lifts up formulas and procedures and programs, and he's going to provide some kind of predictability and control in his life. He's going to do that by inventing those things. Man's going to make weapons, he's going to make medicine, he's going to make insurance, he's going to make legal documentations. Man is going to make warranties and safety and security equipment, and all of this to fortify and protect himself against every seen and unseen danger, right? Isn't that what he's doing? And man is making education and retirement and savings plans and housing, investment, networking, all these things to secure his future, and he's going to make sure that his future is safe. Well, that stuff lifted against God. And it says in verse 17, in that day the pride of man will be humbled, the loftiness of man will be abased, and the Lord alone. Now here again, what part of alone don't we understand? The Lord alone will be exalted. The idols will completely vanish as the things that you make. Whether in here or with your hands, are the things that man makes. And it's the arrogance of man that perceives that in some way, you know, he's controlling through these venues. The passage at the end of Jeremiah 51, verse 58 says, the peoples will toil for nothing. It's fundamentally the theme of the book of Ecclesiastes. You ever read the book of Ecclesiastes? Okay, here's one of the phrases. Vanity, vanity, all is vanity. And if you go through the book, he runs through almost every conceivable pursuit. I mean, he'll go the pursuit of just working hard, of excelling, of making money. He'll talk about pleasure in chapter 2. A very interesting chapter. So I said I was going to be wise and think about pleasure. So I got myself drunk. Okay, so that didn't work. But as it goes on, it begins to read, he goes, but I wasn't happy. I thought that might be the way to happiness. He says, it was Ecclesiastes 7. He goes, you want to know something interesting? He goes, I have found that I felt better at a funeral than I did at a place of partying, because the people at the funeral were thinking deeply, where the people at the parties were thinking superficially. And I realize I don't understand life. The world is futile without God. It makes no sense if you're pursuing the wrong things, and you come up feeling empty. I mean, you're working really, really hard for nothingness. It's an interesting thing that it makes reference to in verse 57. I will make her princes and her wise men, what? Drunk. And then when they sleep, they'll just be dead. Of course, that's exactly what happened. Once again, remember the incident in Daniel chapter 5, which Belshazzar sees the handwriting on the wall. Daniel comes in and he goes, okay, you're going to be dead tonight. Of course, they're partying, they're drawing out all the stuff and from the temple and drinking through the chalices of the temple and not even thinking about what they're doing. And God says, you're going to be drunk, and when you go to sleep, that'll be it for you. The passage reads, that they may sleep a perpetual sleep and not wake up. That's exactly what happened. When they came in, when the Medes and the Persians came in, they just took care of everybody that was drunk. They didn't know what hit them. And the problem is people work all their life for all the wrong things. They finally come to the end of their life, and they go, I don't know what's hit. What happened? And God goes, you wasted your life. Remember what Ephesians 5 says. It says, do not be drunk with wine, for that is dissipation. Dissipation means what? Waste. You're wasting your time. The reason why he has the whole thing of them getting drunk in here is he's saying, why are you doing that? Why do people do that? They pursue certain pleasures. If you were to sit them down and you go, why are you doing that? They go, I don't know. And that would be the wise answer. Some might say, because I felt like it. But there is no purpose in it. What What does getting drunk actually accomplish? Nothing. Except making you a fool. So the passage is saying most of the decisions in your life are like that. You're making decisions that just make you look foolish because you're investing and focusing on things that are wasteful, and it's just, everything's a dissipation. But he goes on, he says, but the will of the Lord is that you be filled with the Spirit, so you know what you need to be doing. Because otherwise you're just wasting your life. I come to this passage, and when you read verse 57, you almost feel like, you know, why would God, you know, have them be drunk? In fact, the way I'm reading verse 57, you correct me if I'm wrong, I shall make her princes drunk. Is that the way you read it? I shall make. Why would God do that? You know, we waste our time, and the misery that comes of it is telling us you're wasting your time. And then finally, when the destruction of those things that we put our trust in comes, that's telling us we're wasting our time. But we come to the end of our life, and it's so sorrowful that it's almost like we have to get drunk to avoid the sorrow. When you read in particular of Noah after he comes out of the flood, what does he do? And why does he do that? Because sorrow has filled his heart. If you look at the end of Proverbs, and Proverbs 31, as the queen is talking to her son, which she knows someday is going to be the great king, it says this in verse 4, chapter 31, verse 4. It is not for kings, O Lemuel, it is not for kings to drink wine. Rulers to desire strong drink. Now, in that particular text, the princes and the kings are drinking. Lest they drink and forget what is decreed and pervert the rights of the afflicted. In other words, they can't really afford to get drunk, because from the lips of their mouths it's going to come decisions. And one arbitrary, accidental moment, they could say something that could change history. But give strong drink. This is interesting, isn't it? Did you ever think Scripture would actually tell you to give strong drink to somebody? Give strong drink to him who is perishing. Wine to him whose life is bitter. Let him drink and forget his poverty. Remember his trouble no more. God, in many respects, is being gracious to these that have wasted their life. They've wasted their life. And God goes, okay, just get drunk and die. And it's sad to believe that many people will end their lives that way. I mean, you feel bad. You don't want them to have the pain and the misery in the end of their life, because so much of their life has been invested in pain and misery, though they thought it was going to be the path of great success and great joy. But God in his grace was even in that, protected him and says, okay, so that you don't live the last few seconds of your life in regret and waste, just get drunk. How many people live their life that way? You see, it's not for us. God has called us to a higher standard. And the reason why people are so miserable is because they've wasted their life. They've worked for nothing. They've toiled for nothing. And I can tell you, it's a very miserable feeling, but you can get rid of it. And all you have to do, and it doesn't mean you even have to change jobs, but all you have to do is you have to do everything for God. Colossians says, whatever you do, do all to the glory of God. And you and I can begin serving him today. When you go to work, you just turn to the Lord. As it says in Ephesians chapter 6, you know, you're working hard, but you're not trying to, you're not man pleasers. You're not doing it for them. You're doing it for the Lord. And everything you're doing for the Lord. And so integrity and all those things always stay intact. But more than that, you're actually enjoying what you're doing because you're invested in it forever. And you realize that God is going to give you opportunity to talk to the people around you. God is going to give you opportunity to minister to them. You realize that the way that you act in any given moment is going to either be a door open or a door closed. So you're going to watch the things that you say, and you're going to watch the things that you do, because you're doing it all for Him. But it's a wonderful feeling to walk away from a day and go, I did that for Him today. My day was not wasted today. There's a great couple of psalms that if I could just have you turn to Psalm 102 and then just another one real quick, just a couple of verses. But in Psalm 102, it says in verse 23, He has weakened my strength in my way. He has shortened my days. I say, O my God, did not take me away in the midst of my days. Thy years are throughout all generations. Of old thou didst found the earth, and the heavens are the work of thy hands. Watch verse 26. Even they will perish, but thou dost endure. All of them wear out like a garment, like clothing. Thou wilt change them all. Have you never read Revelation 20 and 21? But thou art the same. Thy years will not come to an end. The children of thy servants will continue. Isn't that a great, what a great truth that is, of thy servants. See, one of the things that Jesus tells his disciples, he says, you know, I came that you could abide, that you could stay forever. And I came that whatever you do will last forever, that you would bear fruit and that your fruit would remain. I mean, I don't want to waste my life. Psalm chapter 91, if you look with me. You know the song. He who dwells in the shelter of the Most High will abide in the shadow of the Almighty. I will say to the Lord, my refuge and my fortress, my God, in whom will I trust? In other words, I'm trusting in something that's not going to fail me. Watch verse 5. I love these next few verses. You will not be afraid of the terror by night, or the arrow that flies by the day, or of the pestilence that stalks in darkness, or of the destruction that lays waste at noon. 1,000 may fall at your side and 10,000 at your right hand, but it shall not approach you. You will only look on with your eyes and see the recompense of the wicked, for you have made the Lord my refuge, even the Most High your dwelling place. No evil will befall you, nor will any plague come near you. Watch verse 14. Because he has loved me, therefore I will deliver him. I will set him securely on high because he has known my name. The only thing God asks you to do is love him with all of your heart, with all of your soul, with all of your might. Because you have loved him, he'll take care of you. And not only will you be safe, but you'll call upon him and he will answer you. God will be with you in time of trouble, verse 15. He will rescue you, and he will even, and verse 16, he will give you like forever. Long life there is literally forever. There has to be times in your life where you just make a decision. I'm not going to work for nothing. If you'll make that decision, you'll be amazed not only of the happiness that will come in your life, but of the productivity that will come in your life and the satisfaction of doing something that is eternal. Because so many people are working and they're looking and they're going, it's gone, it's gone, it's gone, it's gone, it's gone. And I'm going, you've worked your whole life for nothing. Recently, we've heard of someone passing away that was a part of the church. She had cancer, and I remember when both of them came to the church, and I remember the receiving of the Lord, don't you? From what I understand, the website was a time of great testimony. Our time was not wasted in her coming to know the Lord. She is forever with him. We did not waste our time. And every person that we know that we introduced to Christ was never a waste of time. Never was. God is calling us to not waste our time. Father, we come before you today, and our prayer is we don't want to work for nothing. Just don't want to work for nothing. With our heads bowed and our eyes closed, you see our hearts. We come before you, and we ask you to examine. Thank you, Lord, for giving us Karen and Paul the time that you did, for allowing them to be a part of our lives, but thank you for preserving them. Thank you for saving them forever. Now with your heads bowed and your eyes closed, you just talk to God. You know, this may be that day in which you say, you know what? I'm not working for nothing anymore. Maybe today's the day. You pray a sunny place. You rise and sing as we close with this chorus.
I have decided to follow Jesus. I have decided to follow I have decided to follow Jesus. No turning back. No turning back.
I guess that's what decisions mean. You've decided, so you don't turn back, right? Lord bless you this week.